start with the issue. First of all, I didn't make it through your book. It's a nice thick book, but it's, I have to tell you, for people who are interested in this type of topic, the whys and how people were raised who came into these horrible events, it's a very good book because it's told in vignettes for the killers. So you kind of get to know what happened to them in the past, what kind of crimes they committed, the horror of their crimes. And then there's an analysis about the different rankings. And it's just, it's really well done. It's interesting to read, but it's also on a higher level, I think, than your average serial killer book. And congratulations for that book. Dr. Burkhardt, you did a very nice job along with your co-author, Dr. Stone.
Thank you very much.
So let's talk a little bit about why, first of all, what is the definition of evil?
Well, one of the key things to bear in mind is Dr. Stone and I were interested in conceptualizing evil as an emotional reaction in the person looking at a violent offense. So the idea is that, well, of course, there's going to be overlap with the definition of evil that interprets it as having to do with moral or religious ideas naturally. What we were interested in is how horrified and shocked a person is looking at an act, the fact that there are certain acts that are universally considered depraved and disturbing or disgusting to individuals, and also that the act leaves people completely bewildered because they go so far beyond human understanding. That is critical to understanding the scale, because the whole idea is that crimes and offenses that would be ranked low on the scale are ones that the average person could relate to or almost understand, that if they were in that particular circumstance, they might act in that way, like acting out of jealousy or trauma or self-defense. But the whole point of the scale is that as you move along it, you find that there are offenses that are not really motivated by circumstance so much as the personality of the individual. The point is that the crime becomes more and more bewildering and more horrifying as you go up the scale, as you get more into depraved personality structures where there's no purpose to the crime other than acting out fantasies or personal needs. And in fact, very interestingly, the word evil in English comes from the Germanic word übel, which means extra or beyond. Many languages lack different words for various degrees of bad. But in English, we have this word that implies going beyond. And the going beyond is the essence of evil.
Doctor, let's take a break. I'm sorry, we've got to take these breaks periodically. So I'm going to take a break. When we come back, I want you to describe for our listeners how you and Dr. Stone, in writing this book, came up with these different gradations, if you will, of evil from number one to number 22. And when we come back, you will know more about evil than you probably really wanted to. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back. We're here with Dr. Gary Burkhardt. He is a co-author of a book, The New Evil, Understanding the Emergence, a Modern Violent Crime, follow-up to the great book, The Anatomy of Evil. Dr. Burkhardt, can you very briefly describe how you created this hierarchy of the levels of evil?
Well, the original 22 categories were proposed by Michael Stone. And when we worked together on the new evil, the categories were expanded and updated. There are still 22 of them, but expanded and updated to allow for many crimes and offenses other than mostly homicide, sexual assault, and torture that had really been very central to the way Michael had originally conceptualized them. Two quick caveats before I mention anything else about the scale, one being that it's important to remember that we are not placing in this scale of evil people, we are placing acts in the scale. And the reason being that there are very few people throughout history and in the world that would commit acts that rise to the level, to the definition of evil, day in and day out. It would be absurd to say the person is evil, but their actions would meet those criteria. And the second thing to mention is that the scale is not designed to capture individuals that are operating with a gang or organized crime exclusively, or who are committing acts of war. Those are terrorist actions. Those are things that, would be off the table because we're interested in personal cause offenses, individuals that are doing it for psychological, personal reasons. In a nutshell, the scale moves from crimes that have to do with circumstances committed by individuals that do not really have abnormal personality structures. They're not people that we would call psychopaths, for example, individuals who have a proclivity to be without remorse, charming, manipulative, sensation-seeking, incapable of learning, that certain behaviors are wrong or inappropriate. They lack those features, and they act out of either self-defense or jealousy or trauma, or they are pushed over the edge by a certain life event. That doesn't imply that there's no culpability. It just means that the event is overwhelming or almost seems to require it in their mind. And then the scale moves into a certain aberrant personality features, beginning with people who act out of kind of hot-headedness as a personality structure, or who are narcissistic or have a desire for attention-seeking, and then it moves through various degrees of psychopathy until you get to the extreme end at category, in the 20 categories, in the 20s, where there is extraordinary protracted torture that is being committed by the individual. And the point is to place these personality traits on a spectrum that goes from bad to worse in terms of what one is capable of if acting on the needs and fantasies of that particular personality.
Let's play a little clip that I pulled. This is on this is Ted Bundy. Ted Bundy killed a number of women, was executed in Florida for his crimes. He was an intelligent, handsome man. Quite a bit has been written about him. Can we play that, Jake?
Basically, I was a normal person. I wasn't some guy hanging out at bars or a bum, or I wasn't a pervert in the sense that, people look at somebody and say, I know there's something wrong with him, and just tell. I mean, I was essentially a normal person. I had good friends. I led a normal life, except for this one small but very potent and very destructive segment of it that I kept very secret, very close to myself, and didn't let anybody know about it.
So that, in a nutshell, is what we were talking about is, during the course of his life, he acted normally, and he went to law school, mm-hmm. and he had normal relationships, and he had this one little part of him that was very disturbing. What do you make when you hear his voice as far as how it's relevant to your book?
Well, first of all, one of the things that's important to understand about the type of serial killer that Ted Bundy was, which is the most common type, which is someone who commits serial sexual homicide, meaning that the person repeatedly kills for the purpose of fulfilling a certain psychosexual fantasy. The thing that jumps out immediately about Ted Bundy is that he was what might be called a splitter. Splitting is a psychological phenomenon where a person can be out in the world, be functioning, be friendly, be likable, and then have a sort of fragmented part of the self that harbors a great deal of loathing of other people, particularly of women in his case, and so forth. And the idea is they are both the individual. It's not like the person is dissociated or something. It's just that it's possible to keep these two things kind of walled apart. And so what you see in people like that is you see the So this also with John Wayne Gacy, for example, they can have a home life and a partner and so forth, and then by night, go out and commit these atrocious acts. And, I would say on the scale that Bundy is somebody who would be placed at category 18, which is the category for somebody who repeatedly kills, and there is what might be called non-protracted torture, so that we might see strangulation or use of a rope for choking someone and so forth, as opposed to the kind of extreme protracted torture that's played out in a sort of torture chamber-like setting or in that sort of way by an offender at Category 22. And the vast majority of serial killers of that type are sexually motivated, are these sort of splitter types, And what tends to happen with them is, and this is very key to their psychology, is that you have to think of them like someone who has a fantasy that's profoundly visual that they've had for a long time, and they think of it like casting a movie. The idea is they go out and they find an individual that fits the role, like a casting agent. The person has the unfortunate physical characteristics, you know, to be picked, plucked out of the world by this person. And then after killing the individual, the person keeps doing it over and over again, almost in a sort of strange attempt to perfect the fantasy, to perfect the movie. And sometimes that is so powerful to them that they'll keep trophies or mementos or even films of the event because it's something that in their mind they have brought to fruition and perfected.
I'm going to skip a little bit to the question that I was going to get to later, but I want to get to it now. Let's take somebody like Ted Bundy. Let's just say that for some reason he was released from jail, he wasn't executed, and your job was to make him safe for society, and that you have this burden to do that. Is it possible for somebody who has killed as many times as Ted Bundy killed, he wasn't even prosecuted for all of the crimes that he likely committed and that he actually confessed to, but could you sit down with him and medicate him? Could you counsel away these evil tendencies, the tendencies to commit these evil acts, or is he just gone?
I personally do not believe so. The idea is, you know, one of the things that's very interesting to me about the scale is that the people who are ranked highest on it do seem to be the people most likely to reoffend. And the reason is, I think, that because the motivation is so rooted in the basic personality structure of the person, there really is no reason for them to stop other than that they're behind bars or in some kind of institutionalized situation.
So they
in
would.
Fact,
so I just want to. I just want to interject. So you couldn't say to Ted Bundy, "Listen, the minute you do anything bad, you're going to go right back into jail. Don't you want to be out here? Don't you want to be among the free? Don't you want to eat dinner where you want? Don't you want to be outside?" Could he not comport his behavior at this point?
Well, the way that I would put it is that what we understand about people who are psychopaths, and there is no question that Ted Bundy was a consummate psychopath, it's important to understand that part of the difficulty with individuals like that is that they have problems with decision making based upon that kind of reasoning, and they tend to make impulsive decisions. There are problems with executive functioning, and they don't learn well from previous mistakes. In fact, they tend to be fearless and kind of sensation seeking. It's theorized that there are difficulties with the front of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, that is associated with judgment and impulse control, and the kind of thinking, the logic that you would have just laid out, where somebody has to make a decision that would benefit the self for the future, as opposed to just acting out. And it's also theorized that there's a key role of a part of the brain called the amygdala, which has to do with controlling emotional reactions, so forth. Believed that some psychopaths can't muster up enough excitement to get afraid enough of that kind of outcome to learn that they should avoid it. So that the individual hears this, then it just sort of goes in one ear and out the other. But once out in the world, the need, the desire, so forth, becomes so preoccupying to the person, and they have so much difficulty avoiding slipping into it again, that it's just very probable that the person will do it again. And we know that there are some people of a similar profile that have flat out said, if I were let out today, the first thing I would do is go and find a victim and do it again.
Dr. Gary Brocato, we're going to have to take a break here. And we come back, mm-hmm. We're going to be talking more about the gradations of evil here on the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. Do we have the clip from, that wasn't the clip from Charles Manson, was it? We must have the wrong clip. Ah, that was the wrong one. Okay, let's talk about, we're here with Dr. Gary Brocato. The New Evil is a book that he co-wrote with Dr. Michael Stone. I highly recommend it for anyone who's interested in the issues of evil. And it's not just, it's vignettes and it's very interesting and entertaining, but it's also very insightful as to some of the reasons that these things might be increasing over the years. We have a lot to talk about, but one of the things that I'm really interested in is the the triad of early signs of a serial killer or someone who's going to be evil. Can you talk a little bit about what that triad is, and how prevalent is it in people who end up doing these evil things?
Well, I think what you're referring to is what's called the McDonald triad, which is dates to the 1960s. And the idea is that it was theorized that individuals went on to commit heinous acts, violent offenses that might include sexual assault, rape, murder, so forth, might show three features in their youth, one being kind of torture or killing of animals. Then there was fire setting the idea, and bedwetting past the age of five. And the trouble is that the research on the subject had been very equivocal until about 2018. A very good analysis by Parfit and Alenia was done, where they sort of meta-analyzed all the data on the subject. And what they found, very interestingly, is that one of those features on its own may be associated with one day committing violent offenses, but it's very difficult to find individuals who have multiple of those features. So that it's important to understand that you wouldn't likely find too many people that had all three of those things. The power of those three things to actually predict is very unclear based on those results. But in addition, which is sort of fascinating, that they also found that those three factors are far more predictive, far more associated with coming from an unstable home environment and having poor emotional coping mechanism. So it may be that the reason there appears to be a link between those things and going on to commit violent crime is that they're correlated with, they're linked with having poor coping skills to deal with strong emotions and coming from a very unstable home environment that was affecting them as children.
I think one of the things that fascinates me is, especially when you read the vignettes in your book, is that, you know, some of these, the most horrific people have had, like, not so bad upbringing. I mean, not great upbringings. You don't see people being, you know, being raised in a perfect home. But some of these people, like Dahmer, you know, his upbringing was really not anything remarkable. And even John Gacy, who I'm very familiar with, and I'm familiar with his family members, you know, he had some issues growing up, but they weren't any worse than a lot of us had growing up. And then you flash ahead and look at the horrific acts that he was capable of. You know, I guess I want to talk about, at what point do you think someone is so far gone? And again, you know, part of this is are you wired from birth to be an antisocial personality and a violent person, or is it something along the way that happens to you, or is it a combination of both? And all of your research, what is your best answer to that?
Well, first of all, I think what can be illuminating about the scale for people is the whole point that there are many, many motives underlying violence. And only some of them have to do with having an antisocial personality or any kind of aberrant personality. There are many people who commit violence for emotional or contextual reasons that they're unlikely to ever commit again because their circumstances change or they're capable of remorse and so forth. Now, as far as crime that is associated with abnormal personality, where you're talking about different degrees of narcissism and psychopathy and sadism, the idea would be that we have to distinguish between what's called primary and secondary psychopathy. So primary psychopathy is what's believed to be inborn. A person may have the kinds of difficulties I was talking about, where there could be something abnormal about the frontal lobe or the amygdala of the brain and so forth. And the secondary psychopathy is where an individual has been so horribly treated by life that they can act an awful lot like a hereditary psychopath, but they may not have the biology that you see in somebody who's really a primary psychopath. Now, what's fascinating about this is that some people believe, and it's an intriguing theory, that you may need both ingredients to become a very, you know, a repeat violent offender and a psychopath. So in other words, if a person is born with the kind of sensation-seeking, fearless brain of a primary psychopath, but is treated very well by the world, is loved, and so forth, the person may channel those things into pro-social or leaderly qualities, where their fearlessness and their willingness to do things like run into a war or a fire or whatever can actually be of use to society. And for this reason, some people who have psychopathic traits can be perceived as leaderly or attractive by some people, because it's so difficult to tease apart if that's coming from a disturbed place or it's a sign of being adapted in some way to the environment and to the mind of the onlooker. But what may happen is that people who have that type of brain then have the secondary component of being treated horribly or having very adverse experiences and so forth, and this may lead a person like that into the perfect storm of needing a way to compensate for feelings of powerlessness and boredom and anger and so forth with these elaborate fantasies that then become enacted in adolescence typically, and sometimes with the use of drugs or alcohol that disinhibit them, so that then the individual gets into the pattern of playing out the fantasy over and over again.
And I also find it interesting that so many people on death row, so many people who are who have committed horrible crimes, violent crimes, have had head injuries when they were young. Mm-hmm. AC sustained two significant head injuries when he was young. I believe the Night Stalker had a couple of incidents, one that left him with 30 stitches in his head, and on and on. And if you look through all of the records, you see this. Is this something that's significant, or is it just a coincidence?
Well, there is definitely clear, even from the history of when people first started to understand the brain's role in criminal behavior. There was the famous story of Phineas Gage, who had a tamping iron pass through the frontal lobe and then became a much more antisocial personality afterwards. It's been understood since at least the 19th century that there was some relationship between abnormalities of the brain and this kind of behavior in some people. The trouble is that when do something like, for example, there's a database, Florida Serial Killer Database, that examines thousands of individuals who have committed serial murder. What you find is there are a portion of them who have a history of head injury, but it does not account for a very large portion of them. So that what it looks like is that there are different roads that can lead to an individual having the troubles that we've described or having the traits we've described. And for some of them, there can be very abrupt changes in personality that have to do with brain abnormalities. For example, there have been offenders that are fairly high-functioning, average individuals that then have a horrendous car accident or a motorcycle accident or something, hit their head, and then begin very rapidly afterward committing sexual offenses or other kinds of crimes. But it does not explain all. It is a fragment of individuals that commit those violent offenses.
Dr. Gary Brocato, we're going to have to take a break, but thank you so much for joining us. And I have to have you back because I do want to get to the topic eventually of how crimes are trending and how there are various types of crimes that are increasing and have increased over the last three or four decades. But I highly recommend your book, Dr. Gary Brocato, The New Evil. It's available on Amazon and pretty much everywhere. Thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right.